Welcome to Gear Talk, a podcast on biblical theology. How should we understand the nature of the covenant God made with Abraham? How does it relate to the covenants before and after? What contribution do Genesis 12, 15, 17, and 22 make to our understanding? And how does the whole Abrahamic covenant contribute to how all Scripture progresses, integrates, and climaxes in Christ? This interview with Jason DeRoshi originally aired on Caleb Leonard's Exceptional Theology for the Church podcast on July 8, 2025. It is part of an 8-episode series that walks through all the biblical covenant, and we highly encourage you to listen to all of them. We are going to air it in 2 parts.
Welcome to the Theology for the Church podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Jason DeRoshi to discuss the Abrahamic covenant. Brother, welcome to the show and thanks for joining me for this conversation.
I am delighted to be with you.
Yeah, I've had you on the show before, so we won't, you know, make listeners listen to us talk about our life stories, but still at Midwestern Seminary, still doing biblical theology things, all that going well.
Yes, Midwestern biblical theology. Just got back from my 13th trip to Ethiopia, and that's just part of my ongoing mission. I'm connected with a small mission organization called Hands to the Plow Ministries, weekly Gear Talk biblical theology podcast, and then this ministry globally. And then an unexpected treasure this last year, God led my family to plant a church. So we are I'm pastoring once again, this time Sovereign Joy Baptist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. So it's filling up our lives.
Awesome. That's good. Good to hear, brother. And so maybe to kind of get us into our conversation here, why is it important for Christians to understand the Abrahamic covenant?
Well, the Abrahamic covenant is just foundational to the entire biblical storyline. A problem has been set forth in the Adamic Noahic covenant, this relationship through these two mediators with all creation. And that problem is curse. That problem is global rebellion. And it's specifically through the agency of Abraham and all that would come from him that God has purposed to alter the course of the world, to bring new creation, overcoming the old broken creation. As Paul will say in Galatians 3:8, Scripture foretold to Abraham the gospel when he declared, "In you shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." So this is gospel hope intruding into a world. The need for blessing is established in those creation relationships. And now, through the Abrahamic covenant, we get the workings of God that clarify hope for how that blessing will come.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful just to kind of set the context for this conversation. And it's maybe another one that'd be helpful before we start considering some passages here is how does Abraham and his family kind of inherit the commission and role of Adam and Noah in the storyline of Scripture?
In Genesis 1:28, the first couple receives a blessing from God, and that blessing has its makeup in this commission: be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over all life. And what we have then is this call for those made in God's image, set apart to revere and reflect and resemble God as his royal children on the earth, commissioned to put him on display in the world. The vision is that couple, both made in God's image, would come together and create a God-honoring family that would expand into a God-honoring community until the whole world is filled with God's glory, like the waters cover the sea.
Yeah.
And the fall alters the course of humanity. Rather than operating as God's royal king and queen, Adam and Eve give that royal responsibility of the earth over to the serpent. And from that point forward, he becomes what the New Testament calls the God of this world. Mm-hmm. And yet the vision for humanity is always to fill the earth as those made in God's image, putting him on display, and to reclaim what has been taken to begin to rightly represent, reflect, and resemble God on the planet. And in the midst of this sea of debauchery, this sea of brokenness, we start with all creation, and then we narrow to Adam as a representative of humanity, and then we have this increasing narrowing to Noah as the representative of all living humanity after the flood. And after Noah comes Shem. And through this line of Shem, God brings Abraham. But it's this increasing narrowing. Shem mm-hmm. is this even focused member of living humanity. And out of Shem, through the linear genealogy, that is giving us one descendant in each generation who is hoping in that offspring promise from Genesis 3:15. Mm. In Genesis 5, we move from Adam all the way to Noah, and he has three sons. Then we move in Genesis 11 from Shem all the way to Terah, who has three sons, the first of which is Abraham. And God is preserving this hope of the coming deliverer, generation by generation. And so we have a book that is focused on a vision of expansion. Mm-hmm. And then it's carried along by these headings. These are the generations of. These are the generations of. It's moved ahead through this linear genealogy, knowing that there's two key offspring. There's the serpent, and there's the woman, and the serpent has offspring, and the woman will have an offspring. And they set the stage for a book dominated by genealogy, two different lines of descent. You have the remnant and the rebel, and the rebel mm-hmm. make up most of the culture. And
yeah.
And after we get to through the flood and arrive at the Tower of Babel, when God takes those three families of Shem, Ham, and Japheth and disperses them into 70 nations, as we count them in the Table of Nations in Genesis chapter 10, those 70 nations are set out into the world. God chooses one of them in the line of Abraham, and explicitly says in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, that those very families that were scattered at the Tower of Babel become the object of God's missionary efforts. Hmm. They are the families of the ground that God is going to seek to bless. Or as we move into later promises in the patriarchal narrative, it's the nations of the earth, the very nations, 70 of them, that were scattered at the Tower of Babel, become the object of God's redemptive pursuits. And he'll do that through Abraham and his offspring.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really, really helpful and fascinating. And it's such a fast-paced narrative, right? Genesis 1 to 11. And then it takes a pretty good pause here with Abraham. And so maybe if I just provide a little bit of a map for us, and we'll kind of zoom in on a couple of these key moments in Abraham's life. Some of these key points in the narrative regarding God's covenant with him are the giving of the covenant promise and Abraham's call in Genesis 12. Then there's the making of the covenant, the promise of descendants and land in Genesis 15. Then there's the affirming the covenant, the sign of circumcision in Genesis 17. And then confirming the covenant, or Abraham's obedience and confirmation of the promises by oath in Genesis 22, the story of him and his son Isaac, right? And so maybe let's consider Genesis 12 first, and the passage is kind of divided into two sections, the divine word to Abraham in verses 1 through 3, and then Abraham's response in 4 through 8. And as you note in your work, there are two command kind of promise units, right, in verses 1 through 3 that identify how God would reverse the curse. And they also foresee two major stages in salvation history. I think this is really, really important. So could you unpack those two ideas a bit for us?
I'd love to. It's often missed in our English contemporary translations. We do see it in the New American Standard, but in texts like the ESV or the Christian Standard Bible, the CSB, the NIV, it only looks like there's one command. And that's because the translators note that if there's two Hebrew command forms called an imperative connected by the conjunction, the second one is a consequence of the first. But what's often happened in the translations is that they wash out the fact that the second command is still a command. Hmm. And so I'm drawing attention to the fact that God commands Abraham, go to the land. And then he follows it by three promises. And the Hebrew construction suggests that these promises express the purpose for why Abraham needs to go. Go to the land so that I may make you into a great nation, so that I may bless you and make your name great. So he, as Abraham, is going to become the father of a nation, a single nation in a single land. And God is going to bless him, but he's got to go. So
yeah,
there's a contingency there, but that's not the only command. After he arrives in the land and he's experiencing God's blessing, the call of the text is, and be a blessing. And that command, be a blessing, up to this point, the book has been filled with curse. Curse is the opposite of God. It's a testimony of rebellion. So blessing is in some way representing God, displaying God. And the call is that Abraham or his representative would be this to the world. And the promise that accompanies it is that if you or your representative are a blessing, then I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I'll curse. So God is going to elevate Abraham or his representative as an agent of blessing in the world. And then it explicitly says it by even changing the Hebrew verb form, with the ultimate result being that in you shall all the families of the ground, the very ground that was cursed in Genesis 3. My ESV says earth, but the term is the same as the ground that was cursed in Genesis 3, 17 through 19. The very families of the ground will be blessed. So that's the ultimate goal. And as we step back, just like you were saying, it seems as though we're actually getting a picture of the story of redemption. Abraham will be a father of one nation in one land, but God set apart that nation to raise up an offspring, to raise up an individual through whom all the families of the ground would be blessed. And that only happens in the New Covenant era. So what I think we're seeing here is, like you said, a two-stage Abrahamic covenant. Stage one, Abraham is the father of one nation in one land, and we associate that with the Mosaic covenant era, which really dominates the entire Old Testament.
Yeah.
But then the second command, be a blessing, finds its ultimate resolve only in the New Covenant, where Jesus represents Abraham, as it were, and stands as the agent who blesses the world and through whom all the world now is blessed. So a two-stage Abrahamic covenant, stage one fulfilled in the Mosaic covenant, stage two fulfilled in the new covenant. And we're going to see both aspects as we walk through the Genesis narrative. We're going to see both aspects highlighted at different points. And we're going to see the second stage that's associated ultimately with the new covenant.
Mm-hmm.
That stage, even within the book of Genesis, is going to narrow in on a specific seed of Abraham, a specific offspring of Abraham, who, reaching backwards, is the same offspring of the woman
who was promised
to ultimately crush the serpent's head. So that seed is now realized through Abraham, and it's in his days that blessing will reach the world.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful, and kind of to maybe now's as good a time as any to drill down a little bit on the seed language there, right? Both the Abrahamic and Mosaic covenants incorporate this seed language, but they do it in, you know, various ways. So how do they do that? And how does it relate to Paul's application of the seed designation to both Jews and Gentiles in Christ, right? So I'm thinking of like Romans 4, Galatians 3, right? Is kind of marking a redemptive historical shift from an age of promise to an age of fulfillment.
Yes. So Galatians 3, we're going to go there more during this podcast, I assume. But you have both the singular and the plural realities. You have the declaration in Galatians 3:16 that the promises were made to Abraham and to his seed. It doesn't say seeds referring to many, but and to his seed referring to one who is Christ. And then in Galatians 3:29, as you draw attention to, you get, and if you are Christ, then you become Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. You become Abraham's seed. So, but it only happens if you're in the singular seed. And within Genesis, we see both singular seed and plural seed. Now, just as in English, the Hebrew term for seed is always grammatically singular. But you can look for features in the context to see if the author clarifies whether it's singular or plural. So in Genesis, beginning, for example, with Genesis 3:15, which you've already talked about on this podcast, the seed of the woman is designated as he. A pronoun is used. A masculine singular pronoun is used. He will crush your head, serpent, but you will crush his heel. And so the use of that pronoun designates that the offspring of the woman in particular is a singular male offspring. In contrast to that, when we're in a text like Genesis 17, verses 7 or verse 8, the pronoun that's used with the term seed is plural. So, for example, in verse 8 of chapter 17, it says, God says, I will give to you and to your offspring, he's talking to Abraham, I'll give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Mm. It uses a masculine plural pronoun. So Moses is able to use a singular or a plural pronoun to help clarify for you and me, the reader, whether the seed is singular or plural.
Yeah.
And what I think is very significant is in a text like Genesis 15, Abraham is longing for an offspring. He says, God, what other reward could you give me other than letting me participate in the promise that was given so long ago? And God says, Eliezer of Damascus, he's not going to be your heir, but one from your own loins is going to be for your heir. And from that one from his own loins, an offspring is going to come. Isaac is not the offspring. It's through Isaac, we're told in Genesis 21, that that offspring of promise would be named. And in a text like Genesis 15, God takes Abraham outside and he says, look to the sky, look at the stars. So shall your offspring, who I think is singular in that text.
Mm.
So shall your offspring become. So that singular offspring is going to multiply to as many as the stars. Mm. And Paul in Romans 4 cites that text when he's talking about the reality that the church of Jesus has been expanded, exploded to include the nations. And then he says, so it was promised that the singular individual has become many. And we see it very explicitly then in Genesis 22, which we're going to talk more about. But in Genesis 22, the same singular type pronoun that occurs in Genesis 3:15's offspring promise shows up again when we read this. In Genesis 22, God's going to promise Abraham, after his willingness to sacrifice his son, his only son Isaac, God is going to say, by myself I have sworn, because you've done this and haven't withheld your son, your only son, I'll bless you and I will multiply your offspring like the stars of the sky. That recalls Genesis 15. And that's why I think the Genesis 15 promise about the offspring is a singular seed. Now, after mentioning the stars of the sky, your offspring is going to multiply like the stars, he says explicitly, and your offspring, your seed, will possess the gate of his enemies.
Hmm.
It's a third masculine singular pronoun. And because we know Moses can use, in Genesis, a plural pronoun to designate an offspring people, the singular pronoun clarifies we're looking at an offspring person. The offspring that will multiply like the stars is an individual. And that offspring, the one we know as Jesus, just as Paul said, the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring, who is Jesus.
Hmm.
That offspring is the one who will possess the gate of his enemies. And it's that offspring, that singular seed, through whom all the nations of the earth will regard themselves blessed. We'll talk more about that multiplication and that particular passage a little bit later, I anticipate. But right now, my point is to say, there's a plural offspring of Abraham, a people that will possess the land of Canaan. But after that stage, that's stage one of the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic age, after that stage is when the individual seed will rise. And what we're told is that individual will multiply into a people that we call the church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through that church that the world is going to be blessed, that through the multiplied seed, that individual seed will now be the agent of blessing in the world. That individual seed will possess the gate of his enemies ultimately through that multiplied people.
Hmm.
And so we're seeing two different stages. And as we read Genesis, it's important to keep those two stages in mind. When is Abraham the father of one nation in one land? And when has he become the father of a multitude of nations, and as we'll see, even in a multitude of lands? When does that happen? And it's only in the second stage that the individual descendant of Abraham, the individual seed of the woman, has come to crush the serpent and to bring blessing in the world.
Mm. Yeah, it's really, really beautiful and exciting, super fascinating as well. And so if we kind of hop back to Genesis 15 for a minute, this is where the promises of Genesis 12 are formalized as a covenant, right? And so maybe walk us through just, you know, generally kind of broadly what takes place here and how's it kind of move our understanding of the Abrahamic covenant forward.
Genesis 15 is very significant for the movement of the development of the Abrahamic covenant. We start with the focus on the seed promise, and then it moves to the focus of the land promise. And both play a key role in this chapter. It's Abraham's longing for that offspring that moves God to take him outside and look at the stars. And then it's in that context of longing for that offspring, whom I've argued is an individual, mm-hmm. whom we know of as Christ. It's in that context that the writer of Genesis, Moses, first introduces the language of faith. Mm. Abraham believed the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him as righteousness. So faith in Genesis, we know that faith reaches all the way back at least to Caleb, right? The writer of Hebrews saw Caleb believing, and then he saw Enoch believing and Noah believing. And Abraham, even in Genesis 12, when called to go to the land that he did not know, by faith he obeyed and went. Mm-hmm. But the language of faith first appears here in Genesis 15 in the context of the offspring promise. And for Abraham, it was prospective. He was looking ahead, seeing something, but not having received it. Hmm. Seeing and longing. Abraham saw my day, Jesus said. He rejoiced and was glad. Abraham believed the Lord in regard to the offspring promise. And we have to remember, this is coming in the context of Abraham's wife was barren. It would take a miracle. Abraham mm-hmm. was bringing nothing to this interchange. He couldn't produce the heir. It would mm-hmm. take a miracle. And that sets me into the context of this statement that God counted Abraham's faith as righteousness. And Paul in Romans 4, the very chapter that he's going to talk about the stars in the sky, he reaches back and he says, Christians, that justifying faith is the same justifying faith that you and I enjoy. Abraham was trusting God to do for him what he couldn't do on his own. Mm-hmm. And it's significant that God counted it to him, looked at his faith and counted it to him as righteousness, because righteousness is consistently throughout the five books of Moses about doing, about tangibly aligning with God's definition of right order. And Abraham was bringing nothing. He was not living out what would need to be necessary to see the fulfillment of this promise. But God counts it to him, reckons it to him what was not righteousness. Mm-hmm. It's like Laban, father of Rachel and Leah, later in Genesis 31, whom the girls say, our father reckons us as foreigners. They were his daughters, but he regarded them for what they weren't, as foreigners. And I think that in the first part of Genesis 15, that's what we have happening. God is counting to Abraham what is not, as if he were righteous when he is not. And that's exactly how Paul interprets the text in Romans 4. That's the first half. But then we move to the actual covenant-making ceremony, and it's a fascinating text, and it can seem so strange, because Abraham says, God, how will I know that you'll give me the land? Mm-hmm. And God's response is, bring me a heifer, right? Bring me this cow. And Abraham knows that he's supposed to split the animal in two. And God, we're told, just like he had done with Adam in the garden, he moves Abraham into a deep sleep, and Abraham sees a vision. He's not there. Instead, what he sees is it's like a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. It's a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch, it says. And between these cut animal parts, this presence moves. And I think Moses and his readers, having just experienced the Exodus, the power of God at Mount Sinai, and sometime between Mount Sinai and the death of Moses after the 40 years, during that wilderness period, Moses is writing down Genesis. Mm-hmm. His audience has seen the glory cloud, and I think they would have recognized, this is the divine presence. This is like God himself is moving between these parts. And we have to jump actually all the way to Jeremiah 34 to get a glimpse of what's actually going on. But there we read that God declares the men who transgressed my covenant. So this is a different covenant, but a very similar symbolic act is going on. Sure. God says, the men who transgressed my covenant and did not keep the terms of my covenant that they made before me, I will make them like the calf that they cut in two and passed between its parts. And then God declares the kind of judgment he'll bring upon them. Their dead bodies shall be food for the birds and of the air and the beasts of the field. So they made a vow, a covenantal vow to God when they went between the parts. It was as if they were saying, let happen to me what's happened to these animals if we fail to keep our part of this covenant. Mm-hmm. And they failed. And so God says, in accordance with the covenant, I'm going to make you like the very animals that were cut in two between which you walked. And what's amazing is that in Genesis 15, Abraham is seeing the vision, and it is God who goes through those parts. Abraham's question, how will I know that you'll give me the land? Because that's stage one. And if God fulfills stage one, we can be confident he's going to be able to fulfill stage two. But how will I know? And the answer is God says, let me be destroyed from being God if I fail to fulfill this promise. This puts a promissory punch to the entire Abrahamic covenant. It bears this level of certainty because God has put his own existence on the line. And therefore, whatever God commands Abraham to do, even sacrificing his son, his only son, through whom the victory and the hope and the triumph was promised to come. Even if God says, take Isaac and slaughter him as a burnt offering, Abraham is willing to do it because God has put his own existence on the line. There's nothing comparable in modern day to that type of command given to Abraham to sacrifice his son in light of the covenantal context it's been placed in. Mm-hmm. Everything is hinging on the coming of the offspring who would rise through Isaac's line. And I think Abraham, now years before, is being given a level of certainty in the trustworthiness of his God that is going to impact all the rest of his life.
Yeah, that's super, super fascinating. You can see how crucial it is for just understanding, you know, the God's commitment, right, to this covenant. It's not just like, oh yeah, hey, trust me, Abraham, but there's this visual that he gets that's going to stay with him for the rest of his life, right? And it's written down for us to see. This is the kind of God that we serve and his commitment to his creation, right? To bring about this promise of redemption. I think that's
it builds amazing. Right off of his promises to Noah with God's commitment to withhold that wrath, to point his war bow upward rather than downward. Mm-hmm. It provides the context for this type of saving grace to be operative.
Yeah.
And Abraham is now seeing it worked out. He is going to be the agent through whom all of your and my problems are going to find solution. And you and I and men and women from every tongue and tribe and people and nation around this globe throughout all time are finding hope because of the certainty that God would fulfill what he had promised.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've seen kind of the giving of the covenant, Genesis 12, the making of the covenant, Genesis 15, and then there's the affirming of the covenant. We get the sign of circumcision right here in Genesis 12. And so we get the Genesis 17 here. And so, you know, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you about here, but maybe to kind of start, just what's happening in Genesis 17? How's it connected with what we've seen in Genesis 12 and 15?
Well, Abraham was 75 years old when he left Ur of the Chaldeans for the Promised Land. They hung out in Haran, and yet he is captured and called to the land of Canaan. Then Genesis 15 happens at some point in the midst of it, and when we get to the end of chapter 16, he is now 86 years old. But as soon as we jump into chapter 17, he's 99, which means 25 years have passed since he obeyed God and went, since the God of glory appeared to him in Mesopotamia, moving him, proving to him that he was not only setting before him desirable promises, but that he was a trustworthy promise maker. And that moved Abraham to obey. It's been 25 years of journeying with God. And so when we get to Genesis 17, God is reaffirming the promises so that Abraham doesn't forget. Already, Abraham has taken into his own hands the possibility of having an offspring. He's he's gotten Hagar, and he's bore Ishmael. And yet, that's not the means God intends to supply. And so God shows up. Abraham is 99 years old. And talk about narrative time, like the narrative is the story. Yeah. Narrative time slowing down. The next six chapters are going to take place in only a single year of Abraham's life. From 99 to 100, chapter 17, you get the covenant of circumcision and a promise that Abraham is going to be the father of a multitude of nations. Then in chapter 18, you're going to get the introduction to the Sodom and Gomorrah episode and the promise by Yahweh that 1 year from now, Abraham, you're going to have a son and his name's going to be Isaac, and Sarah's going to laugh. And God's going to say, it's going to happen. And then we're going to come to Genesis 22. This is like the story is going to slow way down, and there's going to be so much detail incomparable to anywhere else in this book. And so God starts out with Abraham, giving him two new commands and a promise. And the structure is identical to the grammatical structure that we saw in Genesis 12. And the ESV actually renders this verse how I wish they would have rendered Genesis 12 to highlight, highlight the two commands and their relationship. God says, I am God Almighty, El Shaddai. Walk before me, first command, and be blameless. So it recognized that here's two commands connected by and the second command, the ESV left as a command form. And then it renders that I may make my covenant between me and you and between your offspring, and that I may multiply you greatly. When God says he wants to make his covenant, that is, give his covenant fulfillment. That's what I think he's saying. And what's significant here is that he stresses it's contingent again. It's conditioned on walking before him and being blameless. Blameless is not about being perfect. Blameless is like the language of being above reproach in the eyes of all those around. And God is calling Abraham to live a blameless life as he walks before him. And the result will be that God will bring about the fulfillment of the covenant. He then goes on and says, your name's no longer Abram, but instead it will be Avraham, father of a multitude. And this pushes us into stage two of the Abrahamic covenant, this vision. So it starts out, Abraham would be a nation, and mm-hmm. then through him, through his being that nation, all the world will be blessed. Well, that was Genesis 12. Now, Genesis 17 is starting with the international scope, and then it's going to move in and narrow in on how are we going to get there. And it's going to start with Abraham being the father of one nation. Mm-hmm. So the vision is, you'll be the father of a multitude of nations. I'll make you exceedingly fruitful and make kings come from you. But then he says, I'll establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you for their generations. So now we have an offspring people. And then he says, I will give to you and to your offspring, this plural people, the land of Canaan. For an everlasting possession, I will be their God. So we've just narrowed in. The chapter starts out with an international focus, but now it narrows in on stage one of the Abrahamic covenant. It will be him being the father of one nation in what's now designated the land of Canaan. And it's in this context that we get the covenant of circumcision as a sign for this particular expression of the Abrahamic covenant. It's given specifically to Abraham. It's called a sign of the covenant, just like the rainbow is a sign. And so we have to say, in what way is it a sign? And there's different types of covenant signs. Usually, they are in some way symbolic, representing either the blessings or the curses of the covenant. So in the Noahic covenant, the sign was the rainbow, and it appears to be in the shape of a war bow pointed upward. So it represented the blessing of the covenant. God was going to withhold his wrath. But in circumcision, you're taking a knife in a covenant where the ultimate hope is offspring, an offspring. And you're taking a knife and using it on the male reproductive organ. And it symbolically appears to say that if you fail in your covenant loyalty, you and your offspring will be cut off. That's the image of circumcision. Now, what's distinctive about it is that only Jews in the ancient world removed foreskin. And this is a little bit of a graphic language, but it's necessary for us, I think, to understand what's going on. Other nations like Egypt circumcised, but circumcision by its nature doesn't require the removal of the foreskin. It only requires the freeing of the glands of the male reproductive organ, or some cultures even do female circumcision, the freeing of the glands of the female reproductive organ. But Israel, only the male reproductive organ, and only Israel among the ancient world actually removed the foreskin. And because of that, it could become a picture. The foreskin became a picture of the nations and what was hostile to God. It was as if there was a shell that was not allowing full freedom as God had intended humans to function. And so it begins to be used metaphorically, even. You and I are aware of how Moses is able to use the language in Deuteronomy of an uncircumcised heart, and how God will circumcise the heart. And by that meaning, he's going to remove that shell that is like the world so that the heart can be free as a spiritual organ of hunger, of desire, and of delight. And so physical circumcision was a sign of a covenant pointing to a greater reality that we find out is only ultimately realized for the majority in stage two of the Abrahamic covenant fulfillment, that is in the age of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us for Gear Talk. For resources connected to biblical theology, visit handstotheplow.org and jasonderoshi.com. To support the work of Hands to the Plow, visit handstotheplow.org.